Okay, so welcome to episode 40 of the Never Iron Anything podcast. A podcast where we relive comics, series, or creators chosen by a guest. The guest this week is another returning guest. I think we're sort of just doing returning guests now. We haven't had many new people come forward, but I quite like the little group of guests we got so far. This week he's a podcaster himself. He's now a podcaster on two separate podcasts, which I've been listening to on a long drive this week. It's Eamon Clark. Hello, Eamon.
Hello, Tony. Stay awesome.
You always keep something back. We've been talking about.
Did I
minutes.
Get that right?
You did. Yeah, exactly. The right podcast at the right moment. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. Good stuff, man. How are you anyway? Are you good?
I'm very well, Tony. Thank you. Thank you for having me back again.
And no, how are you? Enjoyed it, man. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. We've gone for a bit of a biggie this week, haven't we?
We could do. I mean, it could be a lot to talk about, but we're going to be talking about the first issue of the UK comic Warrior from March 1982.
Yes. Now, a comic that even Des Skin himself describes, although he is subject to hyperbole, I think, Des, he describes it as his creative high point. So there you go. Yeah. That's quite something, isn't it?
It is.
So, Warrior Magazine. Now, Warrior Magazine is a weird one because loads of stuff that came out of it was stuff that people now revere, but they don't kind of, a lot of the American readers possibly kind of don't realize it came from a monthly magazine over here.
Stuff, you know, obviously V for Vendetta and Marvel Man Who Becomes Miracle Man starts here, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I remember when there was that big sales thing about Marvel Man, and I remember thinking, why don't they just buy a load of Warrior magazines, because they were like £3 each in the local comic shop. They seem to have shot up. I sent you a screenshot the other day of I had a bit of a panic on and couldn't find my issue of Warrior, the first issue. I eventually found it, thankfully, and didn't have to spend £300 on the first issue.
But it's, so that's what it says on eBay now.
Apparently so, yeah. I even contacted Des and said, I can't find my issue one. Have you got any? And he said, no, I've run out.
Right.
So even he hasn't got any. I know he had like big piles of it that he was selling. You can get everything else, I think, from him. I noticed one eBay seller was selling the whole run for, I think, £400.
Blimey.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, gosh.
What's going on?
Okay.
Okay, so Warrior Magazine is 26 issues, and I'm going to say it had one special. It had that Marvel Man special, didn't it?
They put out some of the old Mick Anglo Marvel Man stories, didn't they?
Yeah, with little twists here and there, didn't it? Because I think it had...
Yeah.
Did it have... who's the bowler-hatted character whose name I'm blanking on?
So Big Ben, with no time for crime, and it had... didn't it have a framing story that Alan Moore and Alan Davis did, Saturday morning cleaning or something, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, the I quite like, and that Big Ben story is drawn by Ian Gibson.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, pretty good. So it came out in between March 1982 and January 85. It was a kind of a monthly. The first issue was 50p or $2. It was actually the second attempt that Des had to make a comic by that name. There'd previously been a Warrior, I think there was maybe three or four issues that reprinted old stories in a very muddied black and white fanzine kind of way.
Right.
But this was published by Quality Communications, which is Des's, was a basement in New Cross, as he describes it. Over the period of its life, it won 17 Eagle Awards, and it won 9 Eagle Awards just in 1983, so that's quite something.
Yeah.
Where did you pick up your first issue, dude?
So this is great. I can tell you the newsagent on Queen's Road in Leicester.
Ah, okay.
Where I walked into in 1982, because I'm a bit older than you, Tony. So I'm at university.
Right.
I've had one of those phases that you go through where you've given up comics because I'm, you know, like I'm a serious chap now. I'm at university studying medicine, you know.
Yeah.
And I walk into this newsagent in 1982 and I think, oh, that looks interesting. I pick it up. I buy that. And it blew my tiny mind, Tony.
Yeah, and me, man, yeah.
This is the moment for me when comics, you know, people say when comics grew up, this is it for me.
Yeah.
What about yourself? Can you remember buying it?
I can. Well, I can remember buying issue 2. So I was 13, I think, and
right.
I was at boarding school. And we used to have to, like, leg it into town with a carrier bag full of your own clothes because we used to have to wear... our uniform into town on a Saturday, which just meant you got beaten up by the local kids. So we sort of had to leg it in. And I remember legging it in, and there was a sort of area near the comic shop that was a park I used to go and get changed in. But on the way there, I bought issue 2 in the newsagents, which I've still got here. And for some reason, was priced 50p on the cover, but in this newsagents, it was 20p. And I still can't work out why that was. So I bought it there, and then I went and read it, got changed in the park, and then waited for, I think it was called The Globe, the comic shop there, to open, and read it. And like you, man, I went back and bought issue 1 after that, but issue 2, I was like, oh my God, this is, firstly, I thought, this is quite adult. You know, it's quite, yeah. Zerk and all these sort of characters were quite saucy. And
oh,
it
very
seemed,
saucy,
yeah. Yeah, and I remember thinking, like you, I think this is like, I only think this is how someone would have felt when they discovered 2000 AD for the first time, because it's got that. It's like the next step forward for me. That's how I felt about it, you know?
Yeah. It's an evolution in comics. It was, yes, and I would go back to that same newsagent and buy it every month.
Right.
And this was, you know, that was me back on board the comics.
Oh, right. So was this responsible for getting you back into it, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This is getting me back into all this stuff. And then, of course, you know, we'll talk a bit about Dead Skin, but we can also talk about Alan Moore, because this is where I started following Alan Moore. And of course, there's a chap that I know you've spoken about him recently on another podcast, Len Wein, of course,
from
American Comics. He apparently was reading 2000 AD and Warrior. So,
oh, okay.
That's where he said he spotted Alan Moore.
So maybe that's where the Swamp Thing connection came from, I'm guessing, I suppose.
I think that's why he rings him up, because there's that famous story, isn't there, that Len Wein rings up Alan Moore in Northampton, in that presumably in that same house that he still lives in now.
Yeah.
And he says to him, you know, it's Len Wein calling from America. And Alan Moore thought it was one of his mates taking the piss and hung up.
I like stories about that Alan Moore now, because we kind of see him this sort of cynical bugger now, don't we? This curmudgeonly old fella now. But I like the fact that there was that going on as well at the time.
Yeah.
I think I discovered Moore for, God, where did I first see him? Probably his 2000 AD stuff, like DR and Quinch, stuff like that, I suppose. And this came around the same time, I'm going to guess, I think.
So I think actually DR and Quinch is the year after this.
Oh, okay, right.
Because when I looked at this, I was thinking, well, what had Alan Moore done at this point?
Yeah.
And he hadn't done very much. His big stuff on 2000 AD will come next year. DR
right,
and Quinch,
okay.
Skiz, and then on to Halo Jones. But yeah, so it's quite, you know, it's early stuff. And of course, we've both watched, I think, a video of Dez Skin talking about the creation of Warrior and the creation of V for Vendetta. And the way Dez tells it, it was David Lloyd
who got him involved, wasn't it?
Yeah. David Lloyd said, I'm working with this chap on Doctor Who magazine. We're doing backup stories.
Now, that might have been where I saw him, because I think I saw it. I got Doctor Who Weekly back then.
Right.
And then I also got the Daredevils, which I think came before this, because Night Raven was an influence on why they did V for Vendetta, wasn't it?
Yes.
So I think, and that ran at the same time. So I think I maybe was Captain Britain I saw him first time then. Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a long time ago, man.
It is. And I think Dez Skin, because he's since released a Warrior issue 0, which was their mock-up of the first issue.
Right.
And at the time, I think he had plans for it to be Night Raven was going to be in the strip.
Yes.
And then Night Raven belongs to Marvel, I guess, Marvel UK at the time.
Yeah.
So he said to David Lloyd, let's do something like Night Raven.
Yeah.
Because Night Raven's that weird pulp crime fighter.
It was a lot of it was text stories as well. So a lot of it was illustrated prose.
And then Alan Moore writes them, and he becomes this sort of like scarred, horribly deformed spirit of vengeance, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. It was great. It was good stuff. And the Captain Britain then was what was turning all our heads as well at the time, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Suddenly took it from being Chris Claremont, just like a British version of Captain America, to like this thing, and you're like, wow, fucking hell, what happened there? That took a leap.
Ages ago, I did an episode about that, the Alan Moore Captain Britain with Alan Davis. I mean, the Jasper's Warp story or the Crooked World, that just blew our minds, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. I was surprised you haven't done this one on. I know when you sent it to me, I said, oh, do you want to do it on your one, or should we do it on my one? And you said, well, why don't we do it on your one? And I'm surprised you hadn't done Warrior before, because it's got that 2000 AD connection written all over it, I suppose, with Dave Gibbons. And
well, yeah, I'd forgotten that Dave Gibbons is in this first issue, but yes, we are planning, we are actually planning to do it on my podcast at some point. There is a chap who wants to come on and do it, and we're even thinking about trying to actually get an interview with Des Skin as well. But yeah, so it will come up at some point, but yes, Warrior. And yeah. Dave, as you say, all the... they're all in here in this first issue, aren't they? A lot of the 2000 AD people. Dave Gibbons is there, and even Brian Bolland's on the back page with that famous Forbidden Planet ad. You know, people like us shop at Forbidden Planet.
I've got that T-shirt now, I think.
Have you?
Buy that T-shirt, I think I wore it to the 40th. Good stuff. It's a weird one as well, and we'll probably try to avoid, because we could do a whole podcast on the legal machinations of this, the various characters in this and the fallings out and everything, but it is one that you can't get collections of as a whole. There's a lot of stuff in there that gets sold onwards. I think at one point when, I mean, it's a weird one because it was in the comics world. I remember going to UCAC and stuff like that and people going, wow, Warrior, you know, that was really the birthplace. And it's one of those things, if you drew an Anna Kappa or one of those sort of genealogy charts, it would be the parents of a lot of other comics, wouldn't it? You know,
Absolutely.
But it didn't sell that well. And in fact, Des is quite open in saying that V Vendetta was one of the lowest selling stories in it, which I found
astonishing, isn't it? You know, that this wouldn't, a comic of this quality with the people involved in it wouldn't, you know, find a market.
Yeah.
And then of course, I think as it goes on in its run, sort of some of the big strips drop out. We get the Marvel Man legal controversy, so that disappears. There's some reprints start appearing, don't they? You know, I think it does. Obviously, the quality, you know, the budget was dropping, presumably, because it just wasn't selling enough.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? It's let's put a pin in the Marvel Man talk for a minute, and we'll go back to that in a second.
Okay.
Because that's a complicated issue, I think, isn't it? I might try and summarise it, but for everyone, it won't be a complete story.
Whole books written about
I've
that.
I've got one sitting behind me. Is it Kamoka, the Marvel Man, or Miracle Man story, I think it's called? Now, at the end of it, it did sell. So Des apparently sold everything. Who knows? But he sold everything to Pacific Comics, who, within a month of the sale, went bust.
Right,
and they their stuff then got sold onto Eclipse, who I'm quite a fan of, and as an American company, they're quite out there. They put out some quite crazy stuff, and that's where a lot of the stories continued. So that's where Marvel Man that had become Miracle Man continued, and we had the famous Birth issue, didn't we? Did you ever read that one?
Oh yeah, I did. Yeah, I went on and read all of those. Yes, I mean, the actual depiction of childbirth in a comic. What a shocker that was. You know, you look back at it now and you think, well. But yes, groundbreaking stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, it goes back to what Alan Moore was trying to say with The Lost Girls, wasn't it? He said, look, we're quite happy to watch people having their heads kicked off, you know, but we're not worried about, we're oversensitive about sexuality, and I think that kind of fits,
you know, showing the natural process of childbirth. You can't do that in a comic or in a film.
So shall we chat a little bit about Des? So Des is something of a comics journeyman. Have you met Des?
No, I've never met him. No, I've read a bit about him, and I've seen that video we've both watched made by University of Brighton Film School, I think.
I think it is. Now, if you search a bit further beneath that, there's a few other ones that are like snatches of different subjects which he talks about. And I kind of get the sense it was written for some kind of documentary or film for some kind of documentary that never came out. But Des is... He's kind of jumped about, I suppose. He famously got asked by Marvel to write a piece on why Marvel UK was failing. At the time, Marvel UK wasn't doing very well, and he got asked to do a piece. And after writing it, he went to meet Stan Lee, and Stan Lee said, "Well, why don't you just take it on?" And famously, Stan Lee said to him, "No, the best thing you can do is just create a character, then give it to other people to get on with it. That's a lovely little job," which of course is what Stan had done for years.
Yes.
And it's kind of what Des does a little bit on this, I think. He starts the ball rolling on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff from nearly 40 years ago, it's difficult to know which version of events to believe. But if you listen to Des, as you say, he came up with some of these ideas and then just handed them off to great creative teams and said, there you go, run with that.
Yeah.
And we get some really great comics from that, don't we?
You do, I think. I think that's true. I think for what he does there, he definitely does. He was very fond of the Warren type of publishing. He was a fan of creepy and eerie and that sort of thing. And he tried to replicate, he said, that within the House of Hammer and House of Horror, Halls of Horror, all the way through to Warrior, which I think kind of shows up a bit. And I think that's maybe why I was taken with it a bit. Even though it was in black and white and I was reading Colour Marvel at the time, it did have that older brother, that adult nastiness to it, I think, that attracted me. Same as it attracted us to 2000 AD in a way, didn't it? It was a bit scary, a bit nasty occasionally.
Yeah, it was. And we spoke about this before because I got confused about the name of the horror magazine, whether it was Halls of Hammer or Halls of Horror or House of whatever. Because I did pick up an issue on eBay after listening to your episode about Brian Lewis, the artist.
Yeah, great. Yeah,
it's great stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
I thought, was that Jason you had on?
Jason Wilson, yeah. He loves his stuff. Yeah, he's really into it, and I can see why. So Des also had a policy. I don't know. Des gets a bad rep sometimes. I'll be honest with you. You hear stories, but I've always gotten really well with him. I've ended up buying some stuff off him on eBay, and him saying, why didn't you just come around and collect it? And I've been had that glass of red wine with him. And he tells a great story, and you go around to, I went to pick up like a couple of long boxes full of magazines, and ended up there for 4 hours. It was one of those sort of visits, which was
fantastic.
And I didn't know it's him, so I knocked at the door, and he opened the door, and I went, fuck me, you're Des Skin. And he went, yeah, come in. And then we had a good chat, and it was good. So I think what you'll see in that video from Brighton, I think, is his basement, I think, where all the comics are. But he had this idea where he decided to pay 2/3 of what 2000 AD were paying.
Right.
And when asked about that, he said, it's 2/3, but you get the rights to your comic, your characters.
Okay.
Whether that continued through, I'm not sure, because of the wranglings around Marvel Man that continued onwards and onwards for years, for decades, didn't they?
Yeah.
But it's kind of an interesting way. And he said it got people, if you know, they were invested, they were going to make do the best work. And I think that kind of shows a little bit in this.
Yeah. It's interesting because he doesn't even put Marvel Man on the front cover, does he?
No.
He had that slight caution about it. But yeah, the stuff they produce, I mean, obviously it's V for Vendetta and it's Marvel Man that go on to have the lasting legacy. But the other stuff... I suppose the character we haven't mentioned yet, Axel Pressbutton, he does get collected. Was that was Eclipse Comics?
It was,
I think,
yeah. And the Spiral Path gets the same treatment, yeah.
Did it? Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah, although it's much shorter. The other thing I just wanted to quickly say about Des there is he also is quite openly says, I never employ people who work in comics, who are fans of comics. Because he says they're just annoying.
Right.
he talks about... he says he also never aims at fans of comics. So he says, if I'm going to do a Blake 7 comic, he says, I'm going to get all three of the Blake 7 fans to buy it.
Right.
And he says, but if you do a comic that's got science fiction and adventure and stuff in there, but includes Blake 7, you're going to get loads more people to buy it. And he says, that's who I'm aiming at. And he did an interview with Bem that I talked about on the Awesome Comics podcast, where he's very, very honest about everything.
Right.
And they sort of sarcastically frame it with him sitting there in a bow tie, smoking a cigar, and like larging it about how you should deal with comics. But I think there's lessons to be learnt from him, I think, definitely. Yeah.
He almost became the British Stan Lee, didn't he?
Yeah, very much
he? It was
so,
like,
yeah. For those that don't know, he was also involved in Marvel UK, Doctor Who Weekly, famously Comics International. I think it was he Starburst as well? I think he was, wasn't he?
Yes, he did Starburst as well, yeah.
He famously ran a comic shop in New Cross, which used to be on my route home from work. So I used to jump off the bus and buy stuff, and that had a huge axe. I didn't only recognise it. It used to be opposite Goldsmiths Art School, if you know where that is, in New Cross on the one way.
Yeah.
And I only noticed it because it had a huge Axel Pressbutton cutout above the on the first floor, so it was kind of level with the top deck of a bus. And I went, oh my god, what's that? It's a comic shop.
Yeah.
And he would often be in there selling comics, and it was quite a cool little shop to go to. And I think that's where. For years, quality magazines was run out of.
The basement from there,
And he's also now probably most famous as being a bit of a sort of eBay seller.
You buy stuff off him on eBay, can't you? I bought that issue zero off him.
Yeah. Very few interviews with him online. You can't. I put him into a couple of podcast catchers and couldn't find anything. I think it was one about a Doctor Who weekly, because that was at the time that was hitting an anniversary and he'd started it off. And that was all. You don't For someone so chatty, there's not that there many podcasts. I mean, maybe he hasn't got our patience, Eamon, you know?
Yeah. Maybe to sit and do podcasts talking to microphones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Maybe wants to meet real people. Well, those are the days. You mentioned the cover. Did you like? Is that something that you're taken with? Do you still think it's a good cover? Or
oh yeah, I do. I mean, that's Steve Dillon, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we've got an Axl Press Button cover. Steve Dillon. They introduced this new character to go along with Press Button, the laser assassin, Mr. Mistralis.
Yeah.
And you know, it's Steve Dillon. It's great stuff.
Yeah,
I like the layout actually. I liked it. It did look like one of those, as you say, 1970s horror magazines, creepy or eerie or something like that.
It's got that sidebar, isn't it, with the extra characters, which I like as well. And there's a little bit of the Silver Age DC about that for me as well, you know, with those Batman family or something like that.
Yeah, extra characters you're going to find inside.
So we've got Father Shandor, Demon Stalker, V for Vendetta. And a hero reborn from present-day Britain, which is a silhouette with a question mark in, which Dez says, I heard in one of the videos he did, was him using what he did on the early Captain Britain. So Captain Britain was trailed for a couple of months in Marvel UK weeklies as this sort of silhouette, you know, coming soon kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's where he nicked that from. Good. Right, so
he gets that, he's got that idea then of taking a sort of an established character, superhero character, and then tearing them apart and rebuilding them, doing something new.
Yeah, which is kind of Alan Moore's raison d'etre now, isn't it?
It becomes his thing, doesn't it?
Yeah. I was trying to think, I was sitting there thinking about Alan Moore, and I'm a fan of him, and I really like his stuff. And I was trying to think, what characters has he done that don't kind of have roots elsewhere? You could say, well, obviously Marvel Man doesn't. This is a Mick Anglo comic. The V for Vendetta is 1984, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
Yes. And it was later on in the series you get the Beau Jeffries saga, which I think was Alan Moore, wasn't it? I think
that was Alan Moore. Yeah. Yeah. With was it with Steve Parker?
It was. That's right. Yeah.
And it's sort of like an Adams family, UK exactly. Adams family,
yeah.
Isn't it?
That's what I was going to say, and that's the Adams family. And I was trying to, in my head, I was trying to think, what has he done that isn't. Because when you look at the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Watchmen and stuff, it's kind of reimaginings. What has he done that is kind of totally original? And the main one I came up with was what's the one we were just talking about, the comedy one from 2000 AD?
D.R. and Quinch.
D.R. and Quinch, yeah, it was the only one I could think of, really.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Or Halo Jones, I suppose.
Yeah, very true. Good one. Yeah.
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 Because I mean, even Skiz was commissioned to tie into the release of E.T., wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there's some, you know, again, there's sort of like lost in the history of time as to whether how much they knew about E.T. when they were writing Skiz or not.
Yeah.
So, but there, yeah.
We'll talk a little. Should we do a little bit on Marvel Man now? So, Marvel Man was originally a character. So what happened was Marvel comic companies in the UK were reprinting, I think it was IPC off the top of my head, were reprinting Captain Marvel, aka Shazam, from the States. Yeah. Shazam fell into a legal battle with Marvel Comics because he was called Captain Marvel and disappeared for years. So because they had that gap in the market, along came Marvel Man, which seems a strange name just to jump on. Do you know what I mean? If you're in legal hot water over a name, but they did, and it was created by Mick Anglo. And now this was the interesting thing I found. I was watching the Kayfabe video channel, and they were doing something on Marvel Man, and they'd done the maths, and it turned out the first issue of Warrior was 19 years since the final issue of Marvel Man.
Right.
Which is nothing, really.
Yeah.
And when we think, what, 19 years ago is 2001, and we're still reading comics from then. I've still got comics in my long boxes I haven't read from 2001.
Still to catch up with. Yeah.
So it shows the key change in British comics, doesn't it, there, from something very simple.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I mean, and you look back, because in this first issue, they do an article. They got an article about Marvel Man.
Yeah.
And they show some of those comics from the 50s and 60s. And yeah, as you say, 19 years seems like nothing, but it's such a change in the way superheroes are going to be portrayed in British comics, isn't it?
Yeah, really does. Yeah. And it was quite extreme. So what did you think about the first issue of Now, just quickly interject before I go over to you, but when they reprinted this in the American issues, and I think in the hardbacks that Marvel brought out later, this wasn't the first few pages. The first few pages was the story from the Marvel Man special, which is it the one where they go in, they close up on Marvel Man's eye? They keep closing up on it.
Do you know the one? Yes, I know. That's right. And he has a quote from
Nietzsche.
Yeah, something about that. Yes, and I will show you the man, I will show you the Superman or something
that's
like
right.
that. That's the one.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, you've got this A Dream of Flying. You've got this Gary Leach artwork, and he's dreaming. And then he's a journalist. He's sort of like, he's middle-aged. He's out of shape.
Yeah.
He's got to go and cover a protest at a nuclear power factory. And it's very sort of, it's very modern, isn't it? It's all really like... in your face and sort of, you know, there's one scene where he's sort of like he's getting onto a train and there's a chap with a bowler hat and it really looks anachronistic even then.
Yeah, it really does. And I mean, back then, I mean, for you and I who were alive at that time, the nuclear protests were all over the telly and we all knew
CND,
kids at school.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah. CND. I remember my sister having a CND badge and all this sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a big thing. And he goes to the demo, and there's like a kid holding a... I love this, the scene with the kid holding the banner that says, just out absorbing some radiation. And I really enjoyed the artwork in this because, to me, it was like another Brian Bolland. That's how I felt
right.
about it. What did you think of the art?
So I thought it was astonishing. Yeah. I mean, it's so spot on. It's so sort of gritty and realistic and detailed from Gary Leach. And I love all the stuff he does with the sort of dream sequences and also the bit where Michael Moran is having a migraine attack in the middle of this sort of terrorist incident that breaks out. So that's all fantastic stuff. And then when he appears as Marvel Man and says, you know, I'm Marvel Man. Oh, wow. It was great.
It was.
I love the artwork. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely loved it, man. It's so clean and accomplished and, you know, I remember reading this and thinking, oh, I wish this was the art in, I don't know, the Avengers or the X-Men or something. Because I know they had about a year, didn't they, to make the first issue. So it was, Dez didn't rush it. I think he got a job as a fashion designer or something like that, helping out in a fashion design house. So that gave him the time to take off to do this. And it really shows in that first strip. And first, Leach does, is it the first three or four issues, I think, doesn't he? He's not on it that
something
long.
Something like that. And then Alan Davis takes over, doesn't he?
Yeah. But the other thing I noticed in this one is he's not a happy character, Marvel Man, is he? He's never, he never really enjoys his powers. There's always something going on. And the last scene of him, I'm Marvel Man, I'm back, they give him that happy moment, don't they? They give him that triumph.
Yes.
Yeah. And just the scene of him taking off, I just loved it so much.
Going flying through the roof, And because he's not going to get many happy moments going forward, is he?
No, it all gets very dark, doesn't it? With
it does, yeah. It's a very dark story, the Marvel Man story, and
it goes
to some unpleasant places.
Yeah, Gary Leach is great. He doesn't do enough, I think. We were chatting about this online recently, weren't we?
You know, we need to have more Gary Leach artwork. I suspect, as you say, if they'd taken a year to prepare this, he had time to do it.
Yeah.
Because, I think one of Gary Leach's issues was always he wasn't the fastest artist.
Yeah, that's what I understand,
So, and I think he had trouble keeping up with the monthly deadline of however many pages he was supposed to do for it, 5, 6, 8, whatever it was.
Yeah.
It's a shame, actually, because he does seem to nail it straight away. This is Marvel Man. This is this new no-nonsense. You know, it's that thing, real superheroes in a real world, you know, that we were starting to get in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Shame that he couldn't keep it up.
Yeah, and it's a line, a through line that we see for Alan Moore's stories as well, don't we, is the reality of what actually being a, you know, superhero is.
Yes. Would it be actually like if there were people like this? Yeah.
Yeah.
And we really get that. And we also get the idea, because it's the same in V for Vendetta, because I don't know about you, Tony. I don't know how far into V for Vendetta you're reading before you realize he's not the good guy.
Yeah.
You know,
he's
not an uncomplicated hero at all. And it's the same with Marvel Man, you know, because what Alan Moore does with him later on when it becomes Miracle Man and what Neil Gaiman picked up,
yeah,
is this idea that they, you know, these gods walking amongst us, and what would actually happen?
Yeah, it's a good one, isn't it? I know you went to have a quick chat about the year, didn't you? Because you were—is that what you were saying? Is this is when comics grew up? Was there anything else you were reading at the time, Heyman?
Well, I think after this, I pick up. Then I find Captain Britain. Then I go back to 2000 AD and read Alan Moore's stuff there. And then, of course, when I find out that he's gone across the pond and he's writing Swamp Thing, which is what, a couple of years, it's a couple of years after that, I think, isn't it? 1984, Swamp Thing, he starts. And so, you know, for me, this was like, oh my goodness, this is completely different. Who is this chap? This stuff he's writing. And when I followed him across the pond to Swamp Thing, those are great comics.
Amazing.
Swamp Thing.
Yeah, still read great. You know? I reread them a couple of years ago. Yeah, so good.
That's why I think that the that Wes Craven Swamp Thing movie with the rubber suit is still possibly one of the most important comic book movies ever, because it makes Len Wein bring back the title and then makes him ring up Alan Moore.
Good point. Yeah.
Not because it's a good movie. I mean, even, you know, it's got Adrienne Barbeau's, or, you know, both of her Barbeaus are in it.
Scene of her, I'm just going to have a bath in this swamp.
And Louis Jourdan plays the villain, doesn't he?
And he's great. And I think he's, isn't he in the sequel as well?
Is he? Yeah. The one with Heather Locklear.
That's one of those bad but good movies, if you ever see it. Oh my God. Yeah, that's pretty rough. There's some good rubber heads in it. I think that's about as far as it goes. Now you saying it, I'm easily influenced, Eamon. I'm going to have to watch it now later today.
Sorry, Tony.
That's right. The other thing I wanted to just quickly mention about Gary Leach, and we might move on to V Vendetta next because that sounds about right, is he also created Warpsmith with Alan Moore, which appears later.
Yeah.
Which is part of the Marvel Man universe. It's part of the sort of continuity of it. And that is probably one of the most beautiful comics you'll see. It's gorgeous.
Fantastic stuff. And they used to, that some of that appeared in that, do you remember A1 comic?
Atomica Press or something like that.
That's it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've got a few of those. And Warpsmith appeared in there. And yes, Warpsmith then becomes important in the Marvel Man universe.
Yeah.
And that's, as you say, that's beautiful work, that is, isn't it?
I think Gary set Atomica Press up with Dave Elliott. I think the two of them set it up.
Oh, right.
That comes from, Yeah, and weirdly, I didn't know this about Gary, that he inked John McCrae on some Hitman issues.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
No, it's good stuff,
I met him once at one of the London Comic Cons and got him to sign one of the covers of Warrior. That he did, yeah.
He was quite a regular in Orbital for a while.
I think he was on the Orbital stand. He was on the Orbital stand at the Comic Con, London Super Comic Con.
Back
when London Super Comic Con was a thing and Orbital Comics was a thing.
I know. Yeah, breaks my heart, man. Yeah, totally. In fact, it was only the last London Super Comic Con was this weekend, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, something?
Was it?
It was the one that was at Islington, if you went to that one.
Yeah, the Business Design Centre, or whatever it's called in Islington. I did go to that one,
I got hugely drunk at that. And left fake notes in people's pencil cases before they arrived. It was quite a saga. I'll send you the link. over to the next one, which is not the next one in the magazine, but probably to me the next one in historical importance was V for Vendetta.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy this? Because I know what Des said, it wasn't the most popular, but were you enjoying this as much as Marvel Man or?
This was my favourite.
Oh, okay, right.
And I think it was partly the story, and it was partly David Lloyd's artwork, where he seems to be working entirely with shadows and light. You know, that the characters seem to be picked out by the light of the strip or the shadows of the strip. And this was always my favourite one. And the weird way that the backstory, you get the backstory of V for Vendetta over the first few issues, don't you?
Yeah.
And you get that detective who's cracking the case,
yes,
figuring it out. That I just love this one. I thought this was fantastic. I still, you know, still two things about it. One is that realisation as the story progresses that actually he's not the good guy.
Yeah.
By any stretch of, you know, the imagination, he's a very weird character who's very damaged.
Yeah.
And that actually what we should be following is young Evie Hammond from this first issue.
Yes.
And then also the weird thing is, because you said Warrior folds in 1984, 1985,
I think. That's right.
And then
it continues on, doesn't
when
it?
Well, because it finishes, or rather it stopped. Spoilers for V for Vendetta. It stops at the moment where you find out that Evie Hammond has been kept prisoner by V himself.
Yes.
And it ends on that cliffhanger. And then DC pick it up and they colorize it and they continue it. But I think that was 3 years later.
I think it was
like
significantly
that.
Later. Yeah. And I think
what a cliffhanger. You know?
No, I know. Yeah. I think, and some of the art was done by Tony Ware, wasn't it, later on? I think he helped out with it.
Right. Okay.
I'm not a fan of the colorized version of it. They try their best to keep it kind of two or three colors, don't they, in that collection.
So glad to hear you say that, Tony. It's always been a black and white strip for me.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't think they've ever have they done V for Vendetta Noir? They do that.
Oh, I don't know
that thing though. Yeah. If there was a V for Vendetta Noir, I'd be all over that.
Yeah,
yes.
me too. Yeah. Yeah, a couple of interesting facts about it. So let's lay it out. So it's basically 1984, set against a sort of Thatcherite, extreme Thatcherite Britain, isn't it? I suppose is the
yeah.
with shades of apartheid and impending doom.
Yes.
People will most, for those who are listening to this and have never read it, people will probably know it for the anonymous masks.
Yes, the masks. That's yeah. now everywhere. Yeah.
yeah. So the Guy Fawkes, it's a modern day Guy Fawkes story, I suppose. And the yeah. Guy Fawkes-esque mask worn by the titular character has been adopted by a couple of different political movements, but mostly by Anonymous. I don't know whether they get any money, residuals for each mask sold, but I'd like to think they did.
David Lloyd ought to.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great design. It was originally called Ace of Shades, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Which is a strange title. And then Des came up with Vendetta. He said he didn't quite like it because it sounded a little bit Italian, but he went for it on that one.
Yeah.
And like you say, it got taken over by DC and later reprinted as the Vertigo imprint. As I say, Des claimed it wasn't as popular during the original run. I have to say it was probably my second favourite.
Right.
I really enjoyed it. It was one that was, as a lot of comics were back then, and a lot of British comics essentially as well were, it's very densely written as well. There's a lot yeah. to it, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, there always is with Alan Moore, isn't
yeah.
there? There's a lot going on. There's a lot of backstory to deliver, and he does it.
Yeah.
And then you get over those first few issues, you get these terrible sort of shocking moments of violence. I thought this was fantastic. Yeah.
A couple of other things is if you've got it open on the first couple of pages, top right of the second page, that was the T-shirt I had that I wore to my first ever gig. I didn't have any metal T-shirts. I only had a black T-shirt with the V Vendetta mask on. And I thought I could probably get away with that. Not everyone will know what it is. And I went and saw Twisted Sister at the Ipswich Gaumont wearing that T-shirt. There you go.
There you but go. Yeah, that's the mask hanging from the peg on his dressing room, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also bought a mask. Go on, sorry, man.
That was a cover of an album as well, wasn't it? Somebody brought out a V for Vendetta.
Oh, did they?
I've got it somewhere in my collection, and that was the cover as well, I think.
Oh, wow, okay. Because later on we got that famous musical episode, didn't we, issue?
Yes, that's it. That's it. I think I've actually got that set to music on an LP.
Oh, wow, okay.
The Vicious Cabaret.
That's it. Oh, that's it. Yeah. So good. Just look at them playing with the format like nobody else did in a comic run 20 something. It's incredible, isn't it, really?
And
the other thing that's worthy of note in this first issue, and something that probably shocked the 12-year-old me, and I thought, oh, okay, I mean, I'm reading something adult here, perhaps I shouldn't be reading it, was that it starts off with her dressing up to go out as a prostitute.
Yes.
So Evie's extremely damaged, and there's elements of this that use. I don't know if it was a subject. I'm not sure if it had happened then, but it's the Stockholm syndrome thing going on, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. When she goes to stay with V, basically, yeah,
yeah.
And he indoctrinates her and then puts her through hell because he's been through hell himself. But yeah, she's going out on the streets for the first time because she's got basically. You got this idea. She's got no money.
Yeah,
and she's forced into doing this. And then she very clumsily propositions what turns out to be one of the secret policemen.
Yeah, Stasi like, aren't they called Fingermen?
Yeah,
or something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. The Fingermen. Yeah, and they are about to. What do they say? You know, we get to do what we want with you, and then we kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, extremely dark, really dark.
Yeah.
This was actually a rewrite of something Moore had previously pitched to, believe it or not, DC Thompson, called The Duel. And it was a story of a transsexual terrorist in whiteface makeup fighting a totalitarian society. And this was a kind of a rethink of it, I think.
Okay.
Knowing what DC Thompson is, I can't see them going
can't
for that.
Can't see them going for that. Not in 1982, no.
Yeah, we talked about Starblazer last week on here.
And I did, so listen to that.
Thank you, mate. And we were laughing because we were thinking that they'd probably be more object more to the fact that there wasn't double spacing in the type or something like that at DC Thompson. I think they've been referred to by a certain uncle of ours as stuffed shirts, I believe is the phrase.
Right, okay, yes.
Now, it does play on a lot of fascism. It plays on a lot of politics. And for those that didn't live through the 80s, they don't appreciate how polarised, like pre-internet, polarised we were as a country. There was the Thatcherism was well and truly in the country at that point. We were about 4 years off the poll tax riots. The country was realising animal rights was on the move. The anti-nuclear movement was on the move. Punk had kind of just played out. It was a polarised time for politics back then, wasn't it? You've been at university, you must have experienced that quite a lot, I suppose.
Yeah, and we think about the 80s as all that sort of cash and excess and loads of money and yuppies and everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, the sort of the hard-fought battles were still going on between what you might call the left side of politics and Thatcherism.
Yeah.
And as you say, we've referred earlier, the CND protests and all this stuff. And then Alan Moore works out this logical progression of, you know, what's going to happen to politics in the coming years? Because this is set 1997, I think.
Right.
So, you know, he works out what could happen in the future. And we get this terrible, you know, there's been some world disaster. And as a result, in the aftermath, this really, this right-wing fascist government has taken over.
Yeah, it really is, isn't
Britain.
It?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that. Cool. Let's move on to one that I think I get a sense that you don't quite think is as good, and that's the Dave Gibbons story. Dave's credited as art on it, and there's no writer credited. So I'm wondering if Dave wrote it or that Des wrote it.
So it's a two-page...
Oh, by Steve Moore. Sorry to interrupt. It's not on the page. It's in the credits. So it's a Steve Moore written. Yeah.
Right. And it's called The True Story. It's two pages. And I completely, when I got this out of the comic box, I'd completely forgotten that this was in the first issue.
Yeah.
And it's Dave Gibbons' artwork. So it's lovely. It's just lovely. But it's a two-page, it's a time twister story from 2000 AD, isn't it?
It essentially is, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a two-page time twister. And it's a time loop story. And I always sort of get a bit fed up with time loop stories. And it just feels, looking at it now, compared to the rest of the comic, and, you know, we've spoken about our love for Dave Gibbons, both as an artist and as a decent human being in the past, haven't we?
Yeah.
So, but it does feel completely out of place in this comic to me. It feels like it should be in 2000 AD. And that's, you know, not to diss 2000 AD, which is my bread and butter, obviously. But that's what it feels like it should be.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? And I wonder whether I'm not realizing now that I know it's Steve Moore, who was a real icon for Alan Moore, no relation. He really looked up to him. He was a big fan of his, and he didn't do enough. He did some work for 2000 AD, but Steve Moore was very into that whole Lovecraftian, you know, aliens, you know, Jesus was an alien kind of saga. And I wonder if I'm not reading enough into it sometimes when I look at his work, you know, this other dimension that he travels to.
But
it's very simple. There's a Clark Kent riff in it, isn't there?
And there's a thing, I mean, it's about a comic book artist, isn't there? Another typical day at the office, it says.
Yeah, it's very well
drawn. I mean, it packs in a lot in 2 days, and it's beautifully drawn.
Cool.
In 2 pages, rather.
Yeah. Moving on, should we talk a little, we can mention the legend of Prester John. Now, I'm maybe my memory's going, but I think this was his only appearance, was it?
I think so. I think this is a one-off strip.
Yeah.
And it's notable for a couple of things. One is that it's basically a strip that leads up to a pun at the end, like a dad joke, which I'm a bit embarrassed about now. But the other thing is the John Bolton artwork.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, we need more of that. We need that. You know, John Bolton.
Yeah.
Again, perhaps not, you know, the most well-known British artist, but look at this stuff. This
incredible.
Is gorgeous.
Yeah. This and the other stuff. He did some Cull and some sort of Robert E. Howard stuff as well in DC and in Marvel. Right. Incredible stuff, just incredible. Also, a little bit on John, he also went to the same technical college as Barry Windsor-Smith, who we talked about recently, East Ham Technical College. He worked in Lookin magazine as well.
Yes.
I must try and find some of that. Some of that Lookin stuff's quite cheap on eBay.
Yeah, those are quite easy to get hold of, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. And he went to
DC. He was at the Nice Con a couple of years ago, wasn't he?
Oh, was he?
A few years back. Okay. I met him once. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realise you were that one, man. I went to them a few times. Yeah.
Okay. We've probably been in sort of like bumping up against each other for years, Tony, and not realising.
Yeah. I had the same with Al Henderson a couple of weeks ago. He was saying, "Oh, I chatted to him at that same table, and I went to that same talk, and there was only like 20 people in the audience of this talk, so he was there somewhere." Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the beauty of the internet, I suppose. It's good and bad. He went to Marvel, like you said, did Cull, but he also did Marauder the She-Wolf, which is worth looking at, and Black Dragon, which is sort of sword and sorcery thing. Really, really good. And then probably most famous to Americans, he did the backups in X-Men Classics, which were little continuations of some of the X-Men stories, which are pretty good. Yeah. And then the Books of Magic at Vertigo.
Oh, right, yeah.
Is that on your reading list post-Sandman, do you think, or...?
Possibly. I mean, I did read the Books of Magic when it first came out, particularly the miniseries, which had the trench coat, introduced the trench coat brigade, didn't
that's
it?
That's right,
And, you know, there's a comic book about a young boy wizard who's got a pet owl. How many years before that did Neil Gaiman write it? But anyway, there we go.
Yeah.
We won't talk about the other one because she's in the news at the moment for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. I remember reading something to say that had been settled out of court and then going back to look at it and that had been deleted. So maybe it's my imagination, Eamon. Maybe I didn't.
Okay.
Maybe I didn't read it at all. But yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? Yeah, so it's a good one too. And also God Save the Queen, he did at Vertigo. Go over to johnbolton.com and there's some amazing pages of art on there. Really lovely stuff.
Right.
Yeah, really good.
It's astonishing work.
It really is. And it's heavily, even though we're on newsprint, you know, the paper's pretty shitty for these issues. It's really dark, but it holds it well. It contains it well, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of ink on the pages, but it's just beautiful stuff. And it does, you know, it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather too
beautiful.
Rather too much lipstick on the last panel, I'm going to say. It did confuse me somewhat.
But, he's probably slightly over made up and it's got and it's all been building up to a pun, which just seems a bit weird, but there you go.
And then we
I'm looking at it now. I don't like that last panel at all.
No, I don't either. It's not in keeping with the rest of it when you've got this sort of grandeur of the night and you know they're on, you know, the first two pages are astonishing, like absolutely astonishing. Talk about it's knights. The Legend of Prester John is I think he's actually a genuine, well, not genuine, he's actually a legend, isn't he, previous to this comic?
Yes, it is,
A medieval sort of king knight adventurer character. And but it's not your shiny knights in armour, it's like dark. You know, the geezer's got consumption, he's about to die. And yes, it was pretty bleak for a kid reading that at my age, yeah. And then we should mention Father Shandor as well, which I didn't realise was a reprint until you told me just then, so I should have known that. But the Father Shandor,
So I think the first three issues were reprints from Halls of Horror or whatever it was called.
Right. Yeah, so he first appeared in House of Hammer, back then it was called that, at number issue 8. He was a medieval monk stroke priest in Transylvania who got thrown out of the magical or got thrown out of the order for using magic and ancient relics. And he roams the world fighting demons. Jaram Sheila is who's later a cover featured character, isn't she? It was full to me. It was full of like he's a priest. He keeps getting tempted by quite saucy lady demons. That's kind of
very saucy. A very saucy lady demon. Yes, a lot of artwork that was very saucy. Yeah, she's a bit like Valkyrie because she wore those. She wears the little sort of pasties metal cones.
Yeah,
isn't she?
Yeah, the classic. Yeah, they don't look comfortable. But you know,
this first story, I was rereading it. I was thinking, oh, there's this other monk in the abbey who's basically watching demon porn in his room, basically, and gets caught, you know. Yeah,
we've all been there. It's a metaphor for now. It's a metaphor for the Catholic Church. There you go. And something I didn't realise, but you did, because we spoke about it earlier, is the character actually appeared in Dracula, Prince of Darkness, a Hammer film, and was played by Andrew Kerr, who will be more famous to people as Professor Quatermass. In the
from
Hammer.
The Hammer, Quatermass, and the Pit film, and also when did some, I think, radio versions of Hammer of Quatermass as well. Yeah, so I think that was, we were talking about this. I think that was the movie, the Dracula Hammer movie, where they couldn't get Peter Cushing to play Van Helsing for that one. Yeah. He was doing something else, and so they introduced this new character, and then Des Skin picked him up in comics in the 70s.
Right, I get you.
Yeah.
And then let's quickly deal with a couple of the other stories. So we've got The Spiral Path, which continues. To me, it's not bad, but it was the one that I didn't quite feel as much. It seemed not quite as polished as some of the other strips, and it felt more like something that I would have seen in maybe Harrier Press or something like that. It's incredibly detailed, but a couple of the panels seemed a bit off for me. But he does draw a lot of horses, so you can forgive him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as they say, comics, one of the hardest things to draw apparently is horses. Yeah. And there's plenty of horses in this first issue. I think it looks beautiful, you know, them riding in the rain, the horses. Again, it's all black and white, this comic. It's beautiful stuff, but I never really got the story, and it never really gripped me, I'm afraid.
Neither. Yeah, I didn't quite understand. It's great to look at. Is it Steve Parkhouse on this one? I can't remember now.
I think it is Steve Parkhouse, isn't it? Yeah.
But for those that don't know, The Spiral Path is a hippy-dippy visual motif for evolution, with a small e. This is a fantasy epic in a troubled land called Tengir. It's sort of full of people who are reincarnated as crows, and it's got a sort of bows and arrows. There's a little bit of the indigenous people of North America feel to it, to me.
Yeah.
But it's worthy, it's brilliant, and I collected the Eclipse comics because they colorized it, and actually of all of the ones, I think this is probably the better one that looks good in color. And then finally, Axel Pressbun, let's do a little bit on him, who was kind of, he had a right now, I haven't read Warrior for a while, but am I right in saying that every time you press the button, he orgasms, I suppose?
He does, yeah, yes. Right. He's got a button in his chest that you press it, and he basically he has a climax there and then. Yeah.
Which is just genius.
Like
you say, he's an assassin. He's sort of cyborg. One arm is a big blade. He's kind of crazy. He's crazy before we had characters like Lobo and these sort of people.
He's a bonkers character, really, isn't he?
And he was created by Alan Moore, was he? I've got a feeling.
So I think this was in Sounds magazine, the music weekly. And Alan Moore was doing little... Because I think that might be... Oh, no, Maxwell the Magic Cat, he was doing for his local newspaper, I think, wasn't
Post.
He?
Yeah.
That was right. And then for Sounds, he was doing... he created Axel Pressbutton. And he was it the strip called The Stars My Degradation or something like that?
Oh, yeah, that rings a bell as well, yeah. Yeah. I think he actually appeared in a music magazine called Dark Star initially. Over to Sounds, as I understand it. Just something I was reading, if it was right. And it was created by him under the name Kurt Vile.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then Pedro Henry, which I think is also Steve Parkhouse as well, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Or is it Steve Moore? I'm not sure.
Oh, no, it might be Steve Moore, actually. Yeah. So you're probably right. Steve Moore.
Yeah. And then Alan Moore was using some weird student pen names at the time. So Jill DeRay was the Maxwell the Magic Cat pen name. And Translucia Baboon as well was another name. Because I often use that when I go out.
That's a great name. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So could you please sign in and prove you're not a robot? Yeah. Translucia Baboon. That's me.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get on Twitter now. Yeah. We'll control all sorts of people. Yeah, and I loved it. Did you did you enjoy about that last one?
So, Steve Dillon's artwork stands out, doesn't it? I mean, it's classical Steve Dillon.
Yeah,
yeah, it's great work. You know, I think did Des Skin discover Steve Dillon on Hulk Weekly, because that's where he starts when he's 16 years old.
Yeah,
or something
I think
like that.
That's his first piece, wasn't it? And he was three months out of school, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So Steve Dillon, you know, great British artist, lovely work.
Yeah.
He's got this sort of characteristic look to his faces, you know, the sort of slightly broken nosed blokes that has in all his pictures. And then, of course, Axel Pressbutton and Laser Eraser, the assassin that he lives with.
Because she was added for Warrior, wasn't she? She was.
Yeah, she's new here. That's right. And then also the character Zerk, who you mentioned earlier.
Sort of, now he'd be a sweaty Pikachu, I suppose.
Yes. A sweaty, nasty, pig-like Pikachu on a floating platform who's just interested in sex and tentacles and slime.
Sex and murder, and it's that. He's kind of a nymphomaniac. But he's just like something with little wings and feet made out of putty who floats around on the sort of hoverboard thing, but seems to sort of go in rooms with saucy-looking science fiction ladies and come out and they're all satisfied, generally. Yeah. And he's into avocado paste, I was noticing in a later story. See,
gets his own strip later on in Warrior, I think. Yeah. And I think Brian Bolland did some more. Was it Gary Leach did some as well?
I think they both did, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful stuff. Yeah, beautiful stuff. See,
just weird. Yeah,
just bizarre. Just who comes up? You know, who comes up with nonsense like that? Oh, it's people like us. There you go. But the see how ahead of their time Warrior were by using avocados. Very important exactly. Now. I know Dan Vanguard is very fond of avocado on toast. His favorite.
There you go. All the all the millennials love it. Yeah. Zerk started it.
Now, on the back of this, like you say, we've got the Brian Bolland advert, the Forbidden Planet, for when it was in Denmark Street. Did you? You must have visited it when it was there, did you?
Oh, I loved it in Denmark Street. I absolutely loved it. I thought that was when it was a real comic shop, and you know, it smelt funny, and it had back issues. I should have been buying the original art, which we talked about before. But I loved it in Denmark Street.
Yeah.
And of course, as it's gone on and become this sort of multinational big business, each time it's become slightly less, because it's moved in London several times, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And each time it became slightly less of a comic shop to me.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as we speak at the moment, they've just laid off loads of staff.
Have they? I haven't seen that. Oh, that's a shame. Yeah. I'm a couple of listeners who work there. Oh, that's a shame. Because for those who don't know, Denmark Street is famously the street. It's where I bought my first guitar. It's the Guitar Street. It's literally
Guitar
a street that just sells guitars. And at that point, science fiction and comics and stuff. And back then, it was a comic shop. And then round the corner, just round the corner on the left, was the movie shop. Did you ever go to that one as well?
Oh, yeah, I remember that as well. That was lovely as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it was all great stuff, that was. I used to, you know, a trip to Denmark Street in the 80s, fantastic.
Yeah. I remember we had a couple of school trips where we would have to go and watch Prime Minister's Question Time.
Oh, my God.
I know, and it was like Thatcher sitting there with a handbag. And I'd watch that for 10 minutes, then me and a mate would leg it up to Denmark Street to buy some comics, first comics or something, you know.
Much more exciting, much more, yeah. Natural. 23 Denmark Street, London WC2. There it says it. Fantastic.
Yeah. And there's some great photographs Good old of days. People doing signings there. And Alan Moore and, you know, Uncle Pat and all these sort of people doing signings. And good,
yeah.
Great. Ah, good.
And it shows up in the pages of Captain Britain, doesn't it? He has a fight outside it. And somebody gets thrown through the window.
Oh, okay.
He's fighting, what's the bad guy called? Slaymaster, I think.
Yeah. I know what you mean, yeah. It also turns up in a couple of Pat Mills' novels. They've got a fake version of it where they go and do signings and stuff.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. Cool. And he's sort of
serial killer.
He's retelling 70s, 80s British comics,
Good. Now, a couple of questions there. That's good, man. I knew we'd rabbit on, but that's like... We normally aim for about an hour for it all, but we've overrun. So a couple of things, you get to. I'm gonna pull a Mega City Book Club job, and so you get to choose an artist from this book. Who do you choose?
Oh, that's a tough one, isn't it? Yeah, because there are so many great artists in this book.
Yeah.
I think I'm gonna stick to my guns and say that David Lloyd, V for Vendetta.
Okay.
To choose a page of his artwork. Just because it had such an impact on me, the darkness of the strip and the darkness of the artwork. But it's a very close race, this one, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about you?
I don't know. I'm really taken with the Steve Dillon stuff. It just when she kills him through the window. I remember reading that and thinking, wow, that's cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that one. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe because he's also the cover artist. But like you say, it's all quality in it. There's no filler.
It's great stuff.
Yeah.
It is quality in this quality comics issue. Yeah.
Yeah. It's got a legacy still. Do you think that it's as well known nowadays, or do you think the 2000 AD crowd, you're more in tune with, do you think they know about it?
I think they do. I think most of the fans know Warrior, and I think most of the fans have got some, you know, a collection or a run of it. There just weren't enough of us, unfortunately, and it probably it didn't get across the pond and make, you know, and sell.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it had a law, you know, was threatened with legal action by Marvel about the character Marvel Man.
Yeah.
And yeah, just didn't sustain, sadly.
Yeah, I always got the impression that Marvel thought that Miracle Man would be the next big thing for them. And it was littered with, like you say, like the 50s and 60s strips, to such a point that I don't think the Americans quite got it.
Yeah.
And to this day, I still haven't bought the hardbacks. I keep meaning to. I've got a run of the Eclipse issues and stuff, but yeah.
So I've got all the Eclipse issues, and I've got, you know, the one where they have the famous battle in London,
yeah,
where I think John Tottleben from Swamp Thing is on the art.
Right.
Yeah. So I've got all those, but no, I didn't buy the hardbacks, and it's strange that they haven't done anything with the character now that they own it themselves.
Yeah.
But yeah. Interesting.
I wonder whether it was something to do with it was around the same time as we had a character called the Sentry. I don't know if you remember him, which was,
yeah, I do remember the Sentry.
Even
yes.
Color wise was similar. Okay. Was there any other series from the run that you rated that came later on? Because a lot of this stuff, you know, they jumped about quite a lot, didn't they? We really got Marvel Man and V Vendetta, but some of the other stories weren't always in there, were they?
No, I mean. I guess the Bo Jeffries saga, yeah, which has been collected, and you can buy that.
Yeah.
That's lovely, I think. But the other stuff that turns up later on, you get artists like Jim Bakey turns, yes, up on a strip. Yeah. We did get Big Ben, the man with no time for crime.
the best byline, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's great. Although even that's interesting because, you know, in the sort of reality-altering world of Marvel Man, it's revealed that he's actually, you know, he's severely damaged by the process. He's not the character that appears in the sort of fantasy version of his own strip, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, Bo Jeffries' saga, I guess, is worth looking at. That's good fun.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I was going to say Bo Jeffries as well. I really like that. And did they add stuff to, and finished it? Is that right? Was there
they extra? Did, yeah. They added material after Warrior and finished it, yeah.
Yeah, and Warpsmith, obviously. And the other one I was going to name was something that came much later. I'm just trying to think what issue it was. Issue 18, which was by Steve Parkhouse, and it was The Demon at the Gates of Dawn, and it was a samurai story.
Bizarre. Oh, yes, I remember.
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely beautiful and very quickly told. But it was at the same time, I think, that... who was it? First Comics were putting out Lone Wolf and Cub. With those Frank Miller covers. And
the Frank Miller covers.
Yeah.
Ooh,
yeah.
I've got those as well.
In the prestige format. Oh, brilliant. Absolutely gorgeous stuff, yeah. And I think I was quite
taken.
We
were buying all the same stuff, Tony.
I know, yeah. We were lining the pockets of the same big companies, weren't we? Yeah. And the other thing I always regret about not getting is I never got the badges. Did you get any badges? Do you remember those?
I remember they used to advertise the badges and you'd see them, yeah. The V for Vendetta mask and Axel press buttons button and everything. Yeah.
There's an Axel. This is, you know, Comics for kids, and it was there was an Axel press button badge with like the button you could press, which would cause you to climax, which has got blood splattered on it as well.
Of course,
great,
yes,
yeah, ideal. That's what you need as a kid, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that's what kids want.
And you could get the Marvel Man, the young Marvel Man, and the kid Marvel Man little badges in the right colours, which are quite iconic, and a Zerk badge. And it's
of course
it's the one where he's got his little weird gas mask, space mask on, where he's travelling about, which always made me laugh as well. There you
and
go.
You could just say, yeah, he's just a little weird space pig. He's fine.
Yeah. Sex mad.
Is it from one of your comics? Is it from one of your comics, son? Yeah, it's fine. It's nothing.
Yeah. Oh, I might find out who's got the rights and ask to start writing some Zerk.
Can we put Zerk back?
I can imagine Mr. Falp drawing that with great humour. Good.
Yes.
Nice.
Hey, use up the supply of avocados.
Yeah. He's such a millennial. He'll love it. Good. Nice one, man. That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. That's exactly what we wanted out of that. We're just going to pause for an advert, and then we're going to ask you a little bit about your stuff that you got going on, if that's right.
Okay.
Imagine a world where every useless, idiotic, and frustrated thought you had could be transmitted to hundreds, thousands, or even millions of people at the press of a single button. Then why not join Twitter? Twitter, fighting an everyday battle against the inner monologue. There you go, Twitter are back on board. Good to see them back. Thanks, Twitter, for the advertising
nice
revenue.
Yeah, nice to see you getting the money from Twitter. Absolutely,
yeah,
yes. Yeah.
Big.
The place to go on the internet if you want to hear terrible opinions.
Yeah, good. So you're a busy man podcasting at the moment. So not only are you busy at work, as you were just telling me, but you're a busy man. So you've started another podcast.
A little spin-off project from Mega City Book Club. So my daughter Jenny came on Mega City Book Club twice, once to do Halo Jones and once to do the Sandman book, A Game of You. Yes. So we decided, because that one went down quite well, we got a lot of positive feedback on that one. So we're doing the whole of Sandman. We've got a new podcast feed called A Handful of Dust.
Yep.
And basically we're putting out one episode for each of the 10 collected trades of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman comic. And then we'll probably go on and do a few extra episodes at the end on some of the spin-offs. Like
yeah,
Death, The High Cost of Living, which was a great mini-series. Yeah. And there's some other little spin-offs that we'll probably cover. So it'll probably only be about 15 episodes in total.
That's great, man.
And it's got its own separate feed. But we're doing that, and it's great fun. And of course, my daughter, we're reading these comics. They're now 30 years old. And what seemed quite progressive and groundbreaking at the time and was, but you look back at it from 30 years on and you think some of it, because, you know, as you've listened to it, you know, my daughter Jenny sometimes calls me on this stuff and says, well, actually, the treatment of women is terrible. Yeah. Or, you know,
she was talking about fridging, I think, on the one I listened to earlier. And
exactly.
That's why I find it really interesting is, I mean, we need to know the opinions of kids because they're the people who are hopefully going to keep the industry going. But the generational differences is so interesting, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's A Handful of Dust, which you can find at handfulofdust.blogspot.com if you're interested in Neil Gaiman's Sandman and listening to my daughter tell me the stuff that I missed when I read it.
You're surprising. You've got a lovely relationship on there as well. It's very much a podcast of equals. Put it that way, you know.
Thank you.
I've got a 23-year-old son, and he and I talk like we're equals now. But you know, if it was a few years ago, it would just be him mumbling and me telling him off.
Right.
You know, sort of. it's great stuff. And what have you? I just listened to the Flesh episode. Really good, man. Loved that. Made me want to go and
Terry
buy that
Mack,
collection.
Yes, talking about Pat Mills and Flesh from the start, 2000 AD.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow, as we record, we've got an episode coming out with Philip Vaughan from the University of Dundee about Doom Lord.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the New Eagle. And, of course, he's, you know, in fact, I even mentioned you on that podcast because I said he was what you would refer to as part of the Dundee Comics Mafia.
Yeah, they are, very much so. I've just come back from there, actually. I was there 2 days
ago. Oh, right.
Yeah, yes, I was out with, it wasn't Philip, it was a couple of the other guys. But, yeah, I met Phil when Pat did a War Comics talk up there. And I was at
that's right.
No, they're good guys. And it's nice to see them keeping it alive up there because, like you say, there's no comic shop in Dundee now. That's a shame.
Strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
The heart of British comics.
Yeah. Doomlord's a good one, man. All those photo stories as well. Oh, dear.
Great stuff.
And the other one I just want to mention is Terry Mack from that Flesh episode. I love Australians, man. I love their honesty, don't you?
Yeah. Yes. They tell us like it is, don't they?
They really do. Yeah. What else you got? Anything else you got on the book pile, the read pile at the moment?
So I've been reading. This time I have been reading some other stuff, Tony,
okay.
Not just homework. I've been reading stuff recommended by the Awesome Comics podcast.
I wasn't digging for that, man. I forgot you mentioned me that. But yeah. So you've read...
So I've recently read Day Tripper by Fabio Moon and Gabriel Barr.
Thoughts?
And that's great comics.
Yeah.
That is lovely.
It's hard to talk about because it's got such a twist in it, isn't it?
It's got twists in it, but it is beautiful and it's moving and it's lovely work.
Yeah, really lovely.
And then the other hardback I've got in front of me at the moment, which I think was one that I read your review of, it's a hardback called Altitude by Oliver Bouquet and Jean-Marc Rochette.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful book as well,
isn't it? It's a kid discovering climbing and his mate and stuff.
It's a real coming of age story about rock climbing.
Yeah.
And you know, him going out on the edge and it's really increasingly dangerous.
Yeah, and he goes out at night, doesn't he, and stuff.
He does, yeah. It's really weird, but it's beautifully done.
Yeah.
And you know, it's weird because when you listen to, you know, rock climbers and particularly people who've done it at a high level like this guy,
yeah.
And they have so many dead friends because people die doing it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's amazing. That was fantastic.
Yeah, there's a book he did after that. I can't see. I don't think it's been translated yet. Which I saw when I was in Angoulême, which is kind of him as an older man wandering across the mountains, and he comes across a wolf and stuff, and that's pretty. And it was put into my hands and offered to Nobro, and I don't think we took them up on it. And I still kick Sam and say, why didn't we buy that book? Why not? You know.
Yeah.
I think I can't remember the publisher now. But it was a French publisher who handed it to me and said this would make a great English language book, and I wish we had done it in the end. But so yeah, Altitude's beautiful, man. It's
And did he write Snowpiercer?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So Snowpiercer starts as a comic and then becomes a film and now a TV series.
That's right.
So
yeah, it's a series of books. I've only read the
so
first
one. So hopefully he's doing all right.
Yeah, I think he's done all right, hopefully. Yeah. I haven't watched the series. I think I saw the movie, but I haven't watched the series. Have you seen it? Or
I saw the first sort of half dozen episodes and they turned it into a murder mystery.
Right, okay.
Because you can't do the sort of class struggle from the back of the train to the front of the train that the movie and the comic book does in a way.
Right.
They have to have something that's ongoing from week to week.
Okay.
So there's a murder mystery, I think, is what it is. It was all right. I preferred the movie.
Yeah, Tilda Swinton's great in that movie.
Yeah,
I watch anything she's in. She's great. Yeah. Yeah, she's absolutely prepared to make herself look ridiculous. And as part
absolutely.
Of the acting, which I loved about it. Yeah. Good stuff, man. That's great. And where can people find you? Where can we find the podcasts you've got going? And where can we find you on Twitter and stuff?
So megacitybookclub.com, you'll find the podcasts. And on Twitter, MCBC Podcast. Just search for Megacity Book Club and you'll find me. And I'm there propping up the might of Twitter, which thankfully is supporting this podcast and you, Tony.
Yes, very
so
true.
That's all
Yeah. Great sponsors. The thanks, man. That's been brilliant. I knew that was a biggie, but I think we tackled it in a sensible way. I didn't want to get too much into the politics of it all, of what's gone on with Marvel Man and who Dez fell out with, but I think we managed it. Yeah. You can find my work at tributepress.bigcartel.com. This was a biggie. We got another biggie next week, so we finally got there. We're doing Killraven.
The literal cover art of the podcast.
Exactly. So yeah. Pete Dorey, returning guest as well, I think you get on well with, actually, Eamon, has challenged me to do. He and I both met McGregor at NICE, actually, funny enough, a couple of years ago. Just a bloke who absolutely didn't let me down in meeting your heroes. Obviously, has been on Twitter today. We've just lost Chadwick Boseman, and
so sad.
Very sad and too early. And Don wrote a lot of Panther stuff, Black Panther stuff, and some amazing stuff. And his other book, which is equally as amazing, is Killraven. So we've got Pete Dorey on, who loves a bit of comics history. And as I'm currently writing a comic that may have a Killraven link to it in a mostly satirical way with Adam Faulp, I've got Adam to read through Killraven. So we're going to do that next week. So that's the
fantastic.
The kind of
looking forward to it.
Thanks,
it's
man.
Been great. I mean, I've been loving this lockdown podcast.
Yeah, there's a lot of it going on, isn't there? A lot of people are putting stuff out. It's been really good. Yeah, my podcast is full of stuff at the moment. My podcast catcher. Good. Thanks, man. And we'll catch up with you. Think of something else, and we'll catch up soon, I'm sure.
Excellent. Thanks, Tony.
Cheers, man.